Hello, and welcome to the Software Stories podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to software experts from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes, and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and you want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Thank you, and enjoy the show. So we've got Robert Gelob here. He's the founder of Kindava and co-founder of HeySummit. Pleasure to have you on the show, Robert. Thanks so much for stopping by, mate.
No worries.
I'm really, really eager to get you on the show because I just think that you're at such a unique time in a founder's journey. You know, it's still relatively young for the businesses that you're building. And, you know, I think it's quite telling in the fact that I mentioned to you, oh yeah, I'm enjoying the short week. And you were like, oh, what short week? Why? Are you on holiday? I was like, oh, do you not know the bank holiday? And you were like, oh yeah, yeah, no, I don't take those. So I thought that was quite telling of probably the reality of the situation in building a startup or multiple in your case. So you know, before we get kind of stuck into that, you know, what was the process like, you know, what was it, I suppose, a bit of your background and then the process to determining that, you know what, I think I'm going to kind of give this thing a go?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in terms of my background, I've always liked to do projects and to build projects out rather than, you know, work in an existing system. If that makes sense. So like right after university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So could have gone into a consulting firm, could have gone to business school, was not mature enough for that. So decided to start a nonprofit where a project where five of us lived and worked on a converted school bus, like in a, you know, big yellow American school bus. And we drove around the U.S. in that converted school bus. We were making short documentary films about people who are doing positive things in their communities, but who weren't getting a lot of recognition from it. And the reason why we did that is basically I kind of wanted to construct a project that would throw me off the deep end or into the deep end and give me a whole bunch of skills that I didn't have. So like large scale logistics, planning, how to manage a team, how to manage a team and live with a team. Those were all the kind of things that I was really excited to get to do, you know, how to fundraise. We had to raise $150,000 for that. So never did that before. So kind of that started me off and got me excited about the idea of taking an idea and setting a bunch of KPIs, really arbitrary KPIs, and just seeing if we could do it. And that was kind of the kickstart. And then I came back to the UK, started working, building programs, but for a university for a couple of years. And Kindava started out of a personal pain. So in 2015, I was talking to who would eventually be my co-founder about our mutual pain of communicating with our families and sharing photos with them. Most of them aren't very tech savvy and they were spread all around the world. And so we were having a lot of kind of personal challenge with that. And so we started doing a lot of research and customer interviews and seeing what else was out there and eventually decided to start Kindava in 2017. So Kindava is a sharing platform for your family. So if you're, you know, if Facebook is not private enough, and if WhatsApp is too noisy, you can use us. There's no ads, no data selling. So quite privacy conscious way of sharing the pictures of the baby in the bathtub, that kind of thing. Right. In terms of like what led us to that point, I was definitely having itchy feet with my job and wanting to start something. Was looking for an excuse to start something, but also looking for the right kind of problem to throw myself into. And as you were saying, you know, when you are starting off like that, you really can't take time off, or you can't think of time being taken off in that way, even though you do definitely need to protect your own mental health. Mm. It's just your hours are never kind of normal. And you know, I'd never taken off much holiday anyway, so I didn't really have a problem with that. Yeah. It is a completely different mindset. And I think there's also a difference between the founder's mindset and what you have to do to build your company, and also what you then expect from your staff. And your employees. It's not to say that you should be taking the burden off of everyone. You should be protecting yourself and respecting yourself just like you would your employees. But at the same time, you should not be expecting everybody else that works for you to be, to be in the office whenever you're in the office, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
There's a different mindset when it is your company and when you're responsible for it and for making payroll and all that good stuff. Yeah. So I don't know if that answered your question, but yeah. That's my roundabout answer.
It almost seems as though you kind of progressed and you were just almost throwing yourself into different areas that you felt you hadn't kind of acquired skills on as much as anything.
Yeah.
You know, and I suppose there's certain areas like, you know, the payroll, et cetera, generating revenue that perhaps you hadn't acquired. And perhaps it almost seems as though that was, in this brief conversation, that was such a motivator to actually go and start a company, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. And I am very bad at learning stuff through reading. I would rather try something and fail at it and then figure out why I failed, and that's then means that I'll do it a hell of a lot better the next time. And surrounding yourself, if you're motivated, you know, you kind of gotta see, everybody has different motivations as to why they start a company. It might be money, it might be because they really believe in the product, it might be countless number of reasons. For me, definitely culture, building a work type of culture that is supportive and okay with the idea of being high growth and profitable was really important. And so from the beginning, perhaps overthinking it, but the idea of the importance of building something that warranted building a team was very important to me. I'm definitely not the kind of person that excels if it's just a one-man band. I specifically like to seek out other people to either be co-founders with me or work with me. I thrive on that kind of diversity of thought. And so yeah, that was also a big part of it. Like, what can I do that I can, so I can build a team and so we can have a bunch of fun together making money? Like that, you know, that was kind of the fundamental thing, if you want to kind of boil it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's interesting. That there's a lot of theories on there out there as well, that it's actually so much more beneficial to have kind of co-founders and to have, if not a co-founder, you know, a strong team around you as you're starting, or an experienced team around you as you're starting, should I say. And even, you know, companies like, Y Combinator, from what I understand, they either totally don't take on sole founders or they like strongly preference co-foundership before they like invest in companies. And I think their kind of theory is around that, you know, is it's just the general healthiness of having people around you as you're trying to build a company. It's just the benefits are, you know, unquantifiable in some cases.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think different people excel in different environments, right? Mm. So in general, there's this book called The Founder's Dilemmas that I would definitely recommend anybody who's listening who is interested in either thinking about co-founders or if they need a co-founder, if they want a co-founder, I'd suggest you have a read of that. And it talks about two types of people. You have control-motivated people, and you have wealth motivated people. And wealth motivated people isn't like money. It's kind of like wealth of ideas, wealth of the business. So if you're a control motivated person, you have a very, very specific vision of what it is that you want to achieve. It's more likely that the product at the end of the day will be quite a pure representation of what it is that you want to achieve, but that will come at the expense of changing things based off of feedback or new ways of thinking or other people's thoughts. So if that kind of appeals to you, then, you know, control motivated is definitely accurate. But it also means that, you know, your team's probably not going to be huge. You're probably less likely to want to get a co-founder, and kind of be reliant on someone else. And you probably won't like the idea of like taking on investment, for example, whereas a wealth motivated person they thrive off of a lot of different people and a lot of different thoughts coming to the table. And so I think that having a co-founder and the reasons why, you know, places like YC or other accelerators like the idea of people having co-founders, in some ways it's efficient as long as you are aligned with your co-founder. So, you know, there's this wheel of responsibility, of startup responsibilities, made up of, you know, 8 or 9 different responsibilities. So marketing, finance, vision, product, all that kind of stuff. If you are thinking about someone for a co-founder, and if you guys overlap on all of those or all the different skills that you excel at, there's less of a reason to have that person on as a co-founder. And it might just be that they're your friend and you want them to kind of join you. Whereas if you're finding someone with complementary skills that you don't have or things that you can't do very well, it's a good sign that you're able to be passionate enough about your idea that you're able to convince someone to take this ludicrous, crazy, you know, leap with you. And there are a lot of people with great ideas that will never have them see the light of day because they don't have the emotional intelligence or emotional awareness to be able to, you know, manage a team or think that they even need that. And I think that it is sometimes a good indicator of, as you say, like health, like having someone along the ride with you, but also willingness for you to work with other people, like play nice with other people and delegate. That's one of the things that I think people miss out on. And like, you know, you have this idea of the solo founder and they do everything. And the CEO always spends, you know, they're proud of having 20-hour work days and all this stuff. But if you are doing that, then you're being incredibly inefficient with your time. And it sends a signal to investors that you don't know how to give up control and you don't know how to trust other people with jobs and with work. And so, I think that there are a bunch of reasons why that's a good indicator. That's not to say that everyone needs a co-founder, but those are some of the reasons.
Absolutely. You obviously talked about the remote working aspect of it as well. How is that dynamic different, if at all, in incorporating that model into the kind of startup workspace? It's obviously something that's seemingly more common now, which is exciting. But, you know, have there been adjustments from perhaps, you know, before you did found a company, the way that you used to operate that you really had to adjust to?
It's a good question. I've never really had the problem of thinking, oh my goodness, we're moving into a remote working environment versus an office working environment. But mostly because I think I've only really had one like office job, and it was a very traditional type of job. It wasn't it wasn't a startup at all. I think that the bigger kind of confusion is actually when I talk to other people about it, and they're like, well, you know, remote workers, you don't know what they're doing. You don't know if they're working, how do you know that people aren't taking other jobs on the side? Or, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of this kind of reactive, fear there, or they don't listen to me or whatever. Right. And I think so from that point of view, it's interesting because you can flip that question back on its head. It's like, okay, well, how do you know your employees in the office are doing their work? You know, I mean, how do you know? Because the work's done, right? Mm-hmm. And the flexibility that comes with, you know, giving your staff member the ability to have a bit of a flexible work style and lifestyle means that you can get a lot more out of them than, you know, if they were kind of feeling like they had to conform to a certain way of working. I think nowadays you mentioned like it's quite exciting. It's new types of movement. I think people are getting a lot more aware about how the whole thinking that people have different ways of working that suits them best. That isn't just a fad, or that isn't just an excuse for not getting work done. It is a fact. Like, there are people who really thrive on working in the office and coming into the office and separating their lives. And there's some that really thrive in being alone and working at home. And others who thrive working while they're traveling, and others who hate that. Right. And I think that it's that you are saying no to a heck of a lot of amazing high quality talent if you aren't able to be flexible. At the same time, some of the learnings that we've gone and gone through is making sure that you figure out what remote working means for you, or remote friendly or distributed working means for you, and also not treating it like just a cost saving measure. So just because people are remote doesn't mean they shouldn't be considered the exact same type of staff member as if they were in the room. You know, I see a lot, like for example, we do have an office, and some of us are in the office, and some of us are outside the office. But if we have a call, like we have a daily stand up, and so everybody, you know, jumps on that call. If one person is remote, then we're all remote. So that means if there are three people in the office, that's three laptops are up. Everybody's on a Zoom call. Everybody sees everybody's face. You're not having one person on the screen with a conference room. You know, little things like that make sure that you're reminding everybody that we're all part of the same team and we're all equal members of the team. Doesn't matter if you're in Thailand this week or, you know, or in the office next week. And at the same time, you have to figure out, like, freedom is not absolute. So there are things that we learned that don't work, that didn't work for us. So there are certain rules that had to be put in place or processes that we all agreed to make sure that we were working effectively and that we weren't missing things. But the same thing happens in the office. And so I feel like a lot of people have this misunderstanding, or they have these concerns about remote working and these fears that aren't really founded. It's just people. It's talking to people. It's making sure that you're working in a way that encourages them and empowers them the most. And you're upfront with how it is that you all work to make sure that the person understands the culture and the requirements. You know, I don't really see it as a huge change or that it was a huge change, but there definitely is, you need to think about it in a bit more of a nuanced way than just, oh yeah, I'm going to have a bunch of teleworkers.
Yeah. You know? It's a refreshing perspective, because I do think for some reason tend to be synonymous with remote working and paying a lesser cost or a lesser cost associated with it. Yeah. It's actually a really interesting point, because I do think that is completely synonymous and unnecessarily so. And I think it's going to take a while to perhaps change those attitudes. But if we do, then, you know, it really opens up opportunities for people, doesn't it? Which, you know, is incredibly empowering.
I think you're right. I think people think remote working is outsourcing. And they associate those two things. And outsourcing is inherent. I mean, both words are quite negative words. You know, if you think about it, they're quite distance forming words. Remote, that means they're not here. So it's really not a great word to use. That's why, you know, some people use distributed, some people use like anywhere workers, a whole bunch of people, you know, they're trying to introduce different types of language. But this whole idea of outsourcing, you are taking a function and you are putting it outside of your organization. Mm-hmm. Whereas a remote staff member is a staff member, they just happen to not be where you are. And I feel like that's a, you know, it's just a different mentality. Like, I mean, another thing that people try and make the distinction between contractors and full-time employees. And legally, yeah, you're either on PAYE in the UK or you're invoicing, right? But it is weird to me that people will employ people, some people as full-time employees and other people as contractors. But they're in effect full-time employees, but they're treated differently. And that's weird. That is odd to me. So like for us, for example, you could choose if you were a UK resident, you could be a PAYE person, or you could invoice us if you prefer that way for your own situation. And if you weren't a UK person, you would be a contractor, because we're not set up in other areas, but you'd get the same amount of holiday. You'd get the same amount of, you know, perks. You'd have regular one-to-ones. You weren't seen as a different person. And we weren't, you know, we rarely hired very short-term people. So for us, contractor versus full-time was maybe a legal distinction, and it depends on where the tax is paid. But, you know, it didn't actually have an impact as to are you a full team member, or are you kind of like a sort of team member? So that's really interesting. And I understand why people have those distinctions, but I kind of wish that wasn't the case. So yeah, I mean, everything that you're saying rings true there.
Absolutely. Interesting. What's next then? How do you plan out, if you do plan at all, the future? Do you set yourself milestones, or how are you looking forward, and is there an organized way in which you do so?
Well, the two businesses that I run are like couldn't be more opposite. So one is a pre-revenue consumer app that won't have revenue anytime soon, heavily reliant on investment and funding that way, and has a lot of a very specific type of user, and mostly mobile. And the other one is a SaaS, web-based program that is entirely B2B. There's no real consumer element to it, and was revenue positive from day one. So you can't really get more opposite than that. And so the former, so Kindava, in terms of planning for the future, it is definitely based off of the targets that we're meeting, but also the investment package and the funding package that we get. And so because of that, that means, you have to sometimes ramp up hiring, ramp up production of certain things if you're anticipating an investment round happening. On the SaaS side, it's, at least so far, it's very much being planned as a no investment business. So that limits you in terms of the growth, the speed of growth, but it gives you more freedom in terms of how it is that you want to grow. So they are fundamentally different. For each one, we have different milestones that we're looking for and we're aiming for. But what those milestones get, one is a revenue-based milestone. The other is, users, engagement, and other types of milestones, so that we can be the most efficient to generate user growth. So they are quite different. I'm a big fan of KPIs, and setting yourself goals. Getting to them is not necessarily the same as the importance of setting those goals. But setting those goals, accountability, and making sure that everybody has their own internal ones are super important. It's far more important, I think, to set them than for the specific, what actually they are, if that makes sense. It helps with calibration. It helps with understanding your own capacity as a team, and as an individual. And so you're not as disappointed when you miss them in the future. The more goals that you set, the more accurate your goal setting should be going forward. And I'm a big fan of that.
Awesome, mate. Cool. And if people want to find you, check out the businesses, where do they find you?
Sure. Kindava is kindava.com, KINDABA.com. And Hey Summit is heysummit.com, HEYSUMMIT.com. You can find those there. And I'm on Twitter at This Is Gelb.
Awesome.
So you can find me there.
Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.